Via satellite, this is the Unistar Radio Network.
Hi, this is Mark Starr, current program director of WAVG Radio. What we're about to do is go back in time. WAVG, WAVE, and WLAP have all served the 940 and 970 frequency in the Louisville area. There's lots and lots of memories. So let's get into those memories with Wave 970.
Can you imagine a world without recorded sound? The telephone, electric lights, the automobile? This was Louisville in the 1870s when our story begins. However, work was first begun in experimentation in radio in the 1840s by American scientist Joseph Henry. Word of Henry's work soon spread to Europe, where Heinrich Hertz was producing the first electromagnetic waves in the mid-1880s. Then Marconi, of whom we've all heard and who receives most of the credit for radio, began producing signals in 1895. Interestingly enough, work was being done in Kentucky, too. Stubblefield held an exhibition in Murray, Kentucky, to show radio's prospects. Meanwhile, new developments rapidly proved radio's growing role as a navigational tool when, in 1909, a dispatch from a damaged ship immediately informed the world for the first time of a disaster. Amateur radio operators began operating throughout the country, and Louisville, too, had its first amateur radio club. The Fall Cities Radio Club consisted mostly of students of Louisville Boys High School in the early teens, so that by 1916, Louisville had 12 amateur radio operators. Among these was William Jordan, who operated out of the Big Six Auto Repair Shop. After World War I, during which all communications experiments were suspended by order of the federal government, Jordan returned to the air, and according to a 1936 article in the Lexington Herald, WLAP was born. It was Louisville's first transmitting radio station and said to be the first transmitting station west of the Alleghenies. Mr. Jordan, who was still operating only in evenings, however, played popular recordings of the day as early as 1918. Let's listen to a brief sample of a popular Victor recording of the day by the American Quartet.
It's a long way to Tipperary.
Wave 970. Refinements of this newfound hobby continued. And in 1921, Mr. Jordan installed a radio receiver at the Waverly Hills Hospital for patients and staff to enjoy his evening broadcasts. The refining continued, and the Big Six Auto Repair Shop on Breckenridge Street still remained the home of the new 9LK, later to become WLAP. Another early WLAP favorite was this Paul Whiteman classic. WLAP broadcast with 15 watts of power at 360 meters, or just over 832 kilocycles. Power was increased to 20 watts, and the frequency was changed to 1,000 kilocycles in 1925. By 1926, Mr. Jordan became disenchanted with radio. After operating WLAP for 11 years, sold the station for $600 to the Reverend Lloyd W. Benedict, pastor of the Virginia Avenue Baptist Church in Louisville. And the transmitter was moved to the church at 2600 Virginia Avenue. Programming now consisted mainly of the church's regular services and other religious programs. The station was expected to have many listeners and was in fact reported to have been heard as far away as the West Coast and from England. In 1927, WLAP had increased power again, this time to 100 watts day, 30 watts at night. And the frequency was again moved, now to 1,200 kilocycles. In 1928, the Federal Radio Commission granted a nationwide frequency reallocation to most existing radio stations due to interference problems, and WLAP was moved to 1,200 kilocycles.
In 1928, Dinwiddie Lampton bought the station WLAP from the Reverend Benedict, informed the American Broadcasting Studios. He moved the studios from the Virginia Avenue Baptist Church to the Inner Southern Life Insurance Building at 1263 South First Street. Programming of about 2 hours daily, plus the broadcasting of church services, continued until July 1929. In June 1929, the station constructed an improved D-tower system, which was referred to in the trades as a six-wire fan. And on July 4th, 1929, WLAP was ready to make its full-time broadcasting debut. The Louisville Herald Post reported in its July 4th edition that WLAP would go on the air for a six-hour period with the objective of obtaining popularity and prominence from being a public servant to the community. The staff was busy planning a series of programs to satisfy the taste of all radio fans. These plans were made by William Ferris, who had served as general manager of WBAM in Nashville, Tennessee, and was assisted by Vivian Adams Wolf, WLAP's new program director. The highlight of the opening evening was at 6:45, when WLAP offered this greeting. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is radio station WLAP, Louisville's own station, broadcasting the first program of what we sincerely hope to be a long and useful life of public service. Then Louisville Mayor William B. Harrison gave an opening address entitled A Key to the City to Station WLAP. In the speech, he signified that WLAP was Louisville's own station. Following this program, in dedicatory speeches, an all-live schedule of talent followed. Joe Anderson and his orchestra, the Harmony Girls, and featured orchestral music with Miller Haas soloist and a studio trio with William B. Ferris soloist. Lorraine Royster and Marguerite Johnson in piano logs, the WLAP melodist, and others. With this innovative new beginning, WLAP continued initiating many firsts that gained favor with the listeners.
Nothing is so beautiful as spring, when weeds and wheels shoot long and lovely and lush.
This has been a message of your Kentucky Division of Forestry and the U.S. Forest Service.
Remote broadcast facilities were installed at the Kentucky State Fairgrounds, and during the week, William Ferris and Harold Logan provided commentary on the activities, including the $10,000 Saddle Horse Show, described at the time to be the world's greatest saddle horse contest, and a description of the various exhibits in the $300,000 Merchants and Manufacturers Building. Provisions were made for the broadcasting of music from the 50-piece Stedham Symphony Orchestra and the Ormsby Village Band and Carborn's Rainbow Exhibition Band. The Herald Post noted that WLAP announcers themselves would be an attraction in their own right. This coverage of this type brought letters of praise from the general public. The week's program following the fair was one of high standards. The Watchtower program of music, the broadcast of services from the Virginia Avenue Baptist Church, a vocal recital by Marcella Roy, and through the week, Frank Rich and the original Southern Nighthawks, and many other fine groups performed on radio station WLAP. In the fall of 1929, Colonel William Thomas Owens became general manager of WLAP, and during his short tenure at WLAP, the station continued to accomplish many firsts in Louisville. President Herbert Hoover was to give a speech from the steamer Greenbrier while the steamer was docked at the 4th Street Wharf. An elaborate loudspeaker system was set up at the levee, but inclement weather forced a change of plans, and Hoover's speech site was moved to the War Memorial Auditorium at 4th and Kentucky Streets. Thousands of people who were unaware of the change began to line the riverbank. The Louisville Board of Trade, who were sponsoring Hoover's speech, realized the dilemma they were in, so they contacted Owens and requested that the WLAP remote facilities be used to feed the loudspeaker on the levee. WLAP engineers immediately started work, and that evening the crowd was able to hear WLAP announcers William Owens and Warren Keith describe the events from the auditorium in addition to President Hoover's address. The efforts were recognized by the Louisville Herald Post October 29th edition. The paper said WLAP once proved again it was Louisville's own station. The following week, the Atwater Kent Radio Third National Finals were broadcast on WHAS, the radio telephone service of the Courier Journal and Louisville Times. Ironically, probably to the disgust of Judge Bingham, the contest was won by WLAP staff vocalist and announcer Harold S. Logan. The newspapers of the day reflected this rivalry. Other than a few paid ads, you would be hard-pressed to find anything written about WLAP in the Courier Journal. It seems that somewhere along the lines, the Louisville Herald Post became a close ally of WLAP and had its staff reporting news and sports each afternoon on Louisville's own station. One of the more popular programs in the 1920s was Harry Roy and the WLAP Thespians, and a popular singing duet called Even Eva, whose theme song, Down the River of Golden Dreams, opened every show.
Down the river of golden dreams, drifting along, singing a song of love.
And you performed between what years?
The latter part of 28 and the first part of 29. I was in a duo. We were called Eve and Eva, and it was at 8 o'clock, I believe, on Wednesday night. But we performed for a half hour together.
On Saturday nights, they had the jamboree at WLAP now.
Right.
What all?
Well, anyone who would like, that had been on the program during the week, could come to what we called a jamboree. And we all kind of got acquainted. It wasn't at that time like you have the recordings and all now. So we just had a nice little jamboree together.
Right. Now, that was all the performers who had performed
any
that?
Any who wanted to.
That week or any who wanted to come?
No, that week, each week.
On December 14th, 1929, the Secretary Hawkins Club held their opening meeting of 114 youths in the WLAP studios. Following the meeting, each group was given a ride in a glider, courtesy of the Caulfield Novelty Company of Louisville.
A History of Wave will return after these messages.
To learn how you can recycle in your area, dial 1-800-CALL-EDF. That's 1-800-CALL-EDF. Recycle. It's the everyday way to save the world. A message from the Ad Council and the Environmental Defense Fund.
Then on my way I'll go to be forevermore a lonely troubadour.
A year's end, WLAP had started broadcasting at 7 a.m. each day, and the number of employees increased from 6 to 35. All of these events were accomplished, although the stock market crashed in October of that year. In January of 1930, WLAP applied to the Federal Radio Commission for a change of frequency and to move tower and studio facilities. This permission was granted in March of 1930. A popular new program started in March of 1930 was the Four Leaf Clover Club and was held for 1 hour at the 5:30 p.m. time slot. The music was played by the Four Leaf Clover Orchestra, conducted by Roy Fisher. Some of the club's first members included Governor Flem D. Sampson and Louisville Mayor William B. Harrison. Under the ownership of Dinwiddie Lampton Sr. and management of Colonel Owens, WLAP achieved many firsts in broadcasting. WLAP broadcast Louisville Colonels games from Parkway Field, blow-by-blow descriptions of local fights, fall-by-fall descriptions of wrestling matches, and more local football games than any other radio station in Kentucky. 1930 also brought a new year for radio station WLAP, and according to an article in the Louisville Herald Post, in February, WLAP had led the way, and although second to WHAS, which at the time had 10,000 watts of power, WLAP, which broadcast with only 75 watts of power, had accomplished more in the previous year than WHAS. Such new innovations as early morning broadcast and other events gave WLAP this popularity. Then on Derby Eve in 1930, WLAP broadcast the Derby Eve fight between Mickey Walker and the middleweight champion Paul Swiderski. This event was fed to 70 stations over the Columbia Broadcasting System. Also on Derby Eve, according to the Kentucky Derby Museum, WLAP broadcast the first network coverage of the Granger Memorial and the Kentucky Oaks, as called by premier CBS sports announcer of the day, Ted Husing. On Derby Day, WLAP and CBS provided the calls of all the racing card, and to the best knowledge, was the first network to provide open-to-close coverage of Derby Day events. In April of 1930, WLAP began construction of his new tower system on Phillips Lane.
band also announced it was going from a part-time affiliate of the CBS network to full-time network affiliation. This would bring the likes of Walter Winchell, Paul Whiteman, Ted Weems, and other top performers of the day to WLAP. By June, a new speech input board had arrived, and the new transmitter sections were arriving from Chicago. The supports for the horizontal wire used for the antenna system arrived by rail from Washington State, and the two 90-foot stems were installed. Engineers' quarters were built, and on July 4, 1930, WLAP increased power. The 4th of July program was hosted by Lieutenant Governor Breathed and featured a parade of stars. Also in July of 1930, WLAP announced a new broadcast from the Steamer America and features the bands Calliope and the dance music of Cy Reinhart's dance band.
I can remember that. Very much so. He was a lot of fun.
You performed with him a few occasions, am I correct?
Well, just freelance. Just when we'd be on a trip with him, well, I'd get up and sing. Usually when there was music, I sang.
William B. Derbick was the WLAP Master of Ceremonies, and the broadcasts were from the foot of 2nd Street and were aired from 7:45 until 8:15 in the evening before the boat cruised up the Ohio River to Rose Island. In early November of 1930, plans were announced for a special Armistice Day program, and at 10:59 a.m., WLAP observed 1 minute of radio silence to honor the slain of World War I. And at 11, read the American Creed. That evening, the station featured music from the WLAP Concert Orchestra, and speeches were made from George Ewald, commander of the Jefferson Post of the American Legion, and Dr. Curtin Pope of the National Security League. Later that evening, WLAP broadcast the Plymouth Community Singers under the direction of the Reverend B.G. Harris and the leadership of J. Everett Harris. They would offer the singing of fine Negro spirituals. Following this singing, a barn dance was held, and entertainment was provided by Hayes Old Timers. Thanksgiving of 1930 was highlighted by the remote broadcast of the Junior League Cabaret Ball from the Crystal Ballroom of the Brown Hotel for the benefit of the Junior League Ward of Cosair Children's Hospital. Music was provided by Harry Thies and his Victor Recording Orchestra at the Hotel Sitton in Cincinnati, Ohio. Other programs of the Thanksgiving week included the Harmony Crooners, the Carefree Crooners from Franklin, Kentucky, the Maddie Boys, and Black-Faced Eddie and Leroy Rapp would also appear. In December 1930, WLAP had 30 employees. And in January of 1931, Dinwiddie Lampton Sr. sold WLAP to Ralph Atlas of the Atlas Investment Company. Ralph Atlas owned WIND in Gary, Indiana, and co-founded WBBM in Chicago.
Well, WLAP was owned by a Louisville man, and he had, I don't know how it worked, but anyway, the CBS bought it in order to get the CBS, he had the CBS programs on WLAP, and the CBS network bought the station to get the contract away from him.
Wilbur Hudson was hired by Ralph Atlas to become WLAP's chief engineer in mid-1931. And that year, Mr. Hudson attempted to increase power and move WLAP to a new frequency with a directional antenna system. WLAP constructed one of the first directional antenna systems in the country. And although proving the system successful, the Federal Radio Commission refused to accept this system, stating that a radio tower can best serve the city, being within 10 miles of a city limit. This policy would be reversed some 10 years later and is now widely used throughout the industry.
Budget, that's our number.
3-6-3-4-3-0.
Yeah, that's our
number. Thereafter, a young Bob and Randy Atcher, appearing with the Atcher family, began performing on WLAP.
Yeah, we're just doing fine. You're going back a long way with this thing, aren't you, Mark?
Yeah, well, back when Randy was still a baby.
Well, we're going back as far as Moses, I think.
See. Well, almost that, huh, Bob?
Yeah, right. I'm older than Methuselah at this point, but I still remember WLAP. and a lot of the people who were involved there. I did so many programs. I did three a day for years for the Independent Retail Grocers Association. And then we did what they call Salesman Sam Sales. I did three shows a day on radio, and then we did in between, we did two appearances at grocery stores throughout the city. And Randy came into the picture when he was still only about 13 years old, and we used to just jam traffic in all directions. We have pictures at home of crowds that took up four blocks in four different directions.
Down at 22nd and Garland, there was
one of those big annual sales.
And there was Salesman Sam, and that's the only time I ever experienced anything like Elvis Presley, because they tore my shirt off and took my necktie and all kinds of things.
They did that to me pretty often, and they would pull hairs out of my head. And that's why my head looks the way it does today.
That's a pretty good excuse. Pretty good excuse.
Well, our dad was bald-headed, and he always said an empty barn didn't need a cover.
Yeah, we changed the old silver-haired daddy of mine to that bald-headed daddy of mine. We used to sing it. Yeah, those were... Of course, I was such a kid that a lot of it just was like excitement for me. You know, I was so glad to be in there, and I remember Bob talking to me about, he asked me first if I knew how to yodel, and I didn't know what yodeling really was. We used to have a call in town when see some friend down the street of three or four blocks, you know, you go, oh, 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 you know, get their attention. Well, I thought that's what he was talking about. You know?
All right.
Then he told me.
He learned. He got to the point where Randy could do anybody's yodel. It didn't make a difference who had invented it. And here he was still with a soprano voice. And yodeling from that, you can imagine how high those notes were when he would break and go way up there into the sky. But the audience got to the point where, well, they would hardly let me sing when he'd come on the stage because they'd start applauding and they wouldn't stop until we'd put him to the microphone.
Some advantages in being a little kid, you know?
Well, it almost sounds like you were a teenage heartthrob, man.
Well, I don't know whether you could call it that or not, but...
Well, now, I want you to know I had more people fighting over me out in the audience than I did over him at that point.
I was too young, I guess. You know, I was too young.
The night that Dad won the Kentucky State Championship for Old Time Fiddle, we were at the Kentucky Theater. And there were two fights between two girls in each case, and I found out later that what they were fighting over was which one of them was my favorite, and I didn't know any of them.
You know, those old days, that Salesman Sam thing, that was a really a fun time, and we did. I still run into people today that'll say, hey, I saw you at the corner of such and such a street back for the Independent Grocers Association when you were just a kid, and I was about 13, 14 then.
They'd have to be awfully old, Randy. Knowing you when they were a kid and remembering it, they probably were grown-ups themselves at the time. So... Well, I'm 77, and...
I'm still just a baby. Yeah, I'm only 72.
Well, that's not old.
No, I should say not. These days, I look at people... Well, Mother is still living. She will be 100 on the 18th of October this year. And I think of her as being elderly, but I can remember when I thought anybody 35 years old was ready for the grave.
Yeah, me too. Well, of course, we were going to talk about WLAP, and it was a sort of a forerunner of what later became WAVE, and WLAP was at 3rd and Guthrie. On Guthrie Street between 3rd and 4th, actually.
Building.
In the Speed Building, yeah. And, of course, when Dad and Raymond and Francis, our two other brothers, came into the picture, we had the family.
And we did a barn dance on Saturday nights there that was, well, my golly, the people were just all over the place. I'll never forget the night that Bernie Smith showed up there with his mom and dad. Now, Bernie, you know, is not real tall, and his mother and dad were shorter than Bernie. And Bernie was about, maybe 6 or 7 years old at the time.
I don't know whether Bernie was ever, I think he was on WLAP, maybe.
I think he was, that's before you and he got together.
And you remember the Stewarts that were on?
Oh, sure.
Alvin and Uri? Now, yeah, these are Alvin Red Stewarts and Gene Stewart's older brothers, Alvin and Uri Stewart, and they had a program on. And Eddie Cavanaugh, what was that? His name played steel guitar. There was another couple of guys who sang, but Bob and I sang together on those programs way back in those days, and that goes back a way. But
this record has Bernie Smith playing a chorus on there. It's one of the finest things I've ever heard from a guitar man. When you go back as far as this was.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we make a little noise music wise to give an idea of what we sounded like. This that you've got queued up there, I think, Mark, is a song that Randy and I just sang together.
The accompaniment on this, Bob, is the old Swingin' Cowboys band that
Really?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I didn't know you had an accordion in that.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Did you?
Yeah. Now, wait a minute. I have to listen to that one again, but on the other one we had, it was the Swingin' Cowboys.
This is a little song called Wasted Tears.
Wasted tears, they drip and dry and love grows colder. If you don't, I'll have to face the lonely years. Remembering and drying up these wasted tears.
Well, that does go back away, Bob.
Yes, it does.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't one of the tunes that I think I wrote that song,
yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
And I you wrote a bunch of them that we recorded too.
Yeah,
and I wrote A Flock of Others.
Mm-hmm.
But Wasted Tears was not necessarily one of my favorites. Arts Everly had called up and asked for something that had a touch of the country of that day, and I just wrote the song to fit it.
Mm-hmm.
On here, Mark, there are at the very beginning, there are a couple of old fiddle tunes that were made in our living room at home, and that was when we were rehearsing for the WLAP barn dance. And if you can get it started, it'll give you an idea.
That's our dad playing the fiddle.
No, I'm doing it.
Oh, you are, huh?
I went over all of our tapes that I had, and I didn't find one that I thought we had done on the air.
Uh-huh.
Well, my fiddling is not anything to brag about, but it gives you an idea of the kind of thing that we were doing back in the old days when we were doing that barn dance program on WLAP. Now, we keep talking about WLAP, and this is WAVE.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if Mark has told them the whole story of how this all came about, but back when I was still here, before I went to Chicago, Ralph Atlas, who owned WLAP at the time, sold it to George Norton. And George sold it eventually to a group in Lexington, and it's still over there. But then he bought WFIW from Hopkinsville and brought it up to Louisville and changed the call letters to WAVE. We did a lot of work for WLAP, and about the time that the switch deal was made, Randy went to the university and I went to Chicago. Anyway, we had an awful lot of fun in those days. I don't know how many people might remember a real fine crooner who was on WLAP. His name was Bernie Burnett. Bernie Burnett was as good as anybody I ever heard in the business. And he was the guy, by the way, who got me a job at Ford Motor Company so I could make a little money.
Yeah. Back in those days, they didn't pay much.
$5 a day. $5 a day was still the highest salary paid in the automobile manufacturing business.
Yeah, yeah. When Henry Ford decided to do that, it really made a big difference.
That's right.
Uh-huh.
And Bernie, he was in the inspection department, and I became an inspector on the line at Ford. Anyway, that was the old West End plant.
Uh-huh.
And Bernie appeared on WLAP regularly, and he brought and introduced various young artists at the time. And one of them, I remember Johnny Ruffner, who was the engineer on the programs that we were doing in those days. Johnny decided that this one, Jeanette, was a very beautiful woman, and he said he was very, very taken by her.
Uh-huh. I remember Bernie Burnett. Of course, so many of these things were when I was kind of a young kid, so remembering them as well as you do is a little different, but I remember those days, and I remember, of course, the time when WLAP changed over to and became WAVE,
yes.
And the studios were in the Brown Hotel.
But you were here, and I was gone already.
Yeah, you'd already gone to Chicago. What was that, 37 or 38?
Well, I was in Chicago in 33 and 34,
mm-hmm.
but I came back, and we worked part of 34 here, then went down to Atlanta to WSB, and from mm-hmm. there over to the WCHS and the West Virginia Network.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there back to Chicago in 37.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that was all because of the contract with Columbia Records.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And they said that I should appear on stations in the area where our kind of music was the most popular.
Uh-huh. Do you remember some of the, Bob, do you remember some of the people who were on WLAP at the same time we were there? Seems to me like the Stewart brothers, Alvin and Uri Stewart, were on there.
Alvin and Uri were just like we were. They delivered papers.
Uh-huh.
They were paper carriers. And Raymond and I, you know, had West Point all sewed up as far as newspapers were concerned. That's my older brother, Raymond, who plays bass with us when the Batcher brothers are all together.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, remembering all of those people, I remember the Lullaby Larkers.
Mm-hmm.
Wilbur Ball and
I remember
Cliff Carlisle.
Yeah, Cliff and Bill Carlisle were both here.
I know.
And but I've been reading a history of the Grand Ole Opry, and Bill Carlisle mentions that among his first appearances on radio were at WLAP in Louisville.
Uh-huh. Well, Joe Blair and his brother Alan also were a team on. Joe played steel guitar, and Alan played straight guitar, and they both sang.
Now, was Lonesome Luke on WLAP?
Yes, but just rarely.
Yeah.
He and Lost Don Miller, and I don't remember the names of all of the people who were involved there, but at one time, WLAP had a big cast.
It did, yeah, what was the name of that park that Lonesome Luke used to play at down on River Road?
Way down on
Lennings,
River Road.
Lennings? Or
you know,
Lennings
I forgot.
Park? Anyway, there was
I appeared with him there.
Yeah, me too. I mean, I think we did too.
You mentioned that old Model T Ford.
Yeah.
One night when I had done an appearance down there, I went out to get in the car to take off, and it wouldn't start. And I found out somebody had, while we were performing, had tried to take the starter off of it, and they disconnected it, but was still hanging there. Well, eventually Raymond fixed it up. Raymond was a master mechanic, by the way, and probably, if you ask him, he still is.
Mm-hmm.
But he fixed it so I could get back home, back to West Point.
Of course, in those days, I was still going to school at West Point, and you'd have to come get me.
Yes, for personal appearances, I would stop after school and pick up Randy. We'd drive a couple of hundred miles someplace, do a show, and come back, and we'd take Randy back to West Point. Then I would come in and do morning radio shows, and then we'd climb in the car again and take off.
Gotta go.
Price may vary in Alaska, Hawaii, and Puerto Rico.
Listen at work, in your car, or at play to the original hits on Wave 970.
WAVG, Louisville.
Details still need to be worked out. Via satellite, this is the Unistar Radio Network.
Is that Bernie Smith is the guitar man in there who takes that terrific break. And then there's Marshall Sasson, who was the top fiddler for WBBM, CBS in Chicago, is the fiddler.
Mm-hmm.
But I want you to listen to this just to remember how good Bernie Smith was even in those days.
Okay.
Talk of pistol packing babies anywhere from here to Hades, and you're sure to hear of one called Mountain Maul. You can bet your bottom dollar she's a law and hoot and holler, and she's got old Grandpa roosting in the tree.
That'll give you an idea how Bernie could play many, many years ago.
Yeah, Bernie was one of the best ever.
Originally, you performed on WLAP, got your start. You were just a kid, right?
Yes, I was born in 1922, and I was about 9 years old when I became just a mandolin player because my fingers were too short to get around the neck of the guitar. And a friend of ours who was named Lonesome Luke, his name was Luke Decker, had a band called Lonesome Luke and his Farm Boys. And some way or other, my dad became very good friends of his, and my dad mentioned it to me about me playing a mandolin. He said, well, let me hear him. So I went down to WLAP before they went on the air. Back in those days, you had no union, you had no salary or nothing like that. But he did appear out at the place called Summers Park, which is located at 3rd Street, I think it's Taylor Boulevard somewhere, Southern Parkway. And I started playing the mandolin. They would put me on a stool because I was so short. And they would let me play mandolin solos and play along with the band, you know. And I was on there for quite some time. And then they would go out to Summers Park. And back in those days, the Board of Health wasn't too particular with you about how old you had to be to get into some place to play or work or anything else. And I would go out there, and I was in my glory. I was on cloud nine, you know. And so that's the way I got with WLAP. And then at the same time, while we was on one studio, either waiting to go on or waiting to go off with somebody else, Bob Atcher and his mother and father and Francis and Randy was in another studio on a show called The Atcher Family. So we was about the two, as far as I know, we was the only two live talents up there, unless you would have somebody like Lost John Miller. Now, you know, I don't know if he was there alive or not, because I was so young that I was just all excited by Lonesome Luke and the Farm Boys. Now, how long we stayed together, I don't know. But that's my story on WLAP. And there was a gentleman who used to be an announcer at WLAP named Merle Tucker. Now, I don't recall whether Bert Blackwell was at WLAP and George Patterson. I know they were over WAVE, but now whether it was after that time, I don't know.
Right,
so that's about it.
After owning WLAP for only about 1 year, Ralph Atlas sold the station to George Norton, the founder of Wave Incorporated.
Special restrictions apply.
Yeah.
Buying the station, Mr. Norton agreed to drop WLAP's affiliation with the CBS radio network. Shortly thereafter, WHAS acquired the CBS network. This could be supportive to Dinwiddie Lapton's claims. WLAP began operating without network programming in 1932, and WLAP ran from 6:30 a.m. until 11 p.m., strictly with local entertainment. 1932 was the beginning of a two-year legal battle for WLAP. And on September 30th, 1932, WFIW, located in Hopkinsville, Kentucky, applied to move its operations to Louisville. WFIW operated with 1,000 watts of power at 940 kilocycles and was recognized as one of the most powerful stations in the state. WFIW was founded on February 1927 and was owned by the Acme Milling Company, Millers of Very Best and Blue Wing brands of flour. The call letters of WFIW stood for the whitest flour in the world. According to an article published December 17, 1927, WFIW had gained nationwide popularity. Letters poured into the station from almost every state in the United States and Canada, and responses were received from Spanish Honduras and the Panama Canal Zone. Hal C. Fitter was the chief announcer, and Rye Reiner, formerly with WLAC in Nashville, was the associate announcer. Also on the announcing staff were Billy Anderson, who was president of Acme Mills, Clyde Smith, and Judge Alvin B. Clark, who was a city court judge in Hopkinsville. The program director was Miss Fred Jackson. The main studio was known as the Golden Studio and was one of the most beautiful in the United States, with a color scheme of black and gold used throughout. The reception room had a seating capacity of 1,200, and guests could see all broadcasts through plate glass doors and windows and hear the program through loudspeakers. A weekly dance was given by the Prim Royal Ramblers, a dance ensemble. WFIW was enjoying many successes while in Hopkinsville and became affiliated with the National Broadcasting Company. It was NBC who urged WFIW to move to Louisville. NBC had been affiliated with WHAS, but was dropped by that station in favor for the CBS radio network. Meanwhile, WLAP had interest of their own in becoming the new NBC affiliate in Louisville, and George Norton didn't like the idea of WFIW moving from Hopkinsville to Louisville. So began a long series of hearings before the Federal Radio Commission. The first of these hearings were held on December 9, 1932, and according to the Courier-Journal, a debate between opposing counsel opened the proceedings. Sharp exchanges developed when Paul M. Siegel, counsel for WLAP, introduced evidence that WFIW was advertising patented medicines of questionable merit and because of these practices should lose their broadcasting license. On the other hand, the Louisville Herald Post reported that the evidence was brought out that indeed Barry Bingham Sr. had some ownership in WLAP. George Norton was brought to the stand and stated that afternoon that it was from Barry Bingham, son of Judge Worth Bingham, that he learned of the sale of WLAP last winter. Mr. Norton also stated that although at the time Barry Bingham was connected with WHAS, he now was connected with the Courier-Journal. Mr. Norton testified that he bought WLAP from a representative from CBS for $37,000 with the condition that WLAP give up his CBS affiliation. WLAP accused WFIW of filling in fake commercial logs, and so on and on the debate went, with both stations wanting the same end result. On December 10th, WFIW announced that the transmitter site for its news station would be on Ruby Lane. And on March 22nd, WLAP made a final plea to keep WFIW from transferring operations to Louisville, claiming the move would bankrupt WFIW. On June 1933, the Louisville Herald Post reported the commissions ruled in favor of WFIW and permission was given for them to move operations into Louisville. Attorneys for WLAP announced they would appeal, and WFIW delayed any movement to Louisville until a ruling from the Court of Appeals was made. On October 26, there still hadn't been a court ruling, and WFIW announced that it had been in negotiations with WLAP and had agreed to sell WFIW's equipment and transmitter to WLAP for $110,000.
I went and supervised the removal of all the equipment and bringing it to Louisville. And they decided to put it atop the Brown Hotel on the 15th floor. And we put a 250-foot tower on top of the Brown Hotel. And we had the power we were allocated by the FCC was 1 kilowatt at that time. And I'm looking at a picture here of me standing in front of that old transmitter. And I think it was about 3 years after we went on with that why we got boosted up to 5 kilowatts and we had to go use a directional antenna and we changed frequency to 970.
Plans were announced to lease the 15th floor of the Brown Hotel and locate the transmitter on the hotel's roof. On November 18th, WLAP applied to the Federal Radio Commission to operate the recently combined operation of WLAP-WFIW under the new call letters of radio station WAVE. Permission was granted and the commission stated that WLAP would have to cease operations when WAVE took to the air. On November 24th, Nathan Lord announced, along with NBC station relations manager Fred Weber, the station's opening plans, and a gala grand opening would be held at the Crystal Ballroom of the Brown Hotel. The Herald Post announced that J. Graham Brown and Harold E. Harder of the Brown Hotel would be assisting in the arrangements, and the network officials were busy making bookings for the opening night. Work was progressing well on WAVE when the builders went on strike over a dispute that non-union personnel were being used to erect the tower. On December 23rd, the Louisville Herald Post announced the schedule of events for WAVE's grand opening, and the headlines read, "Nationally known artists are signed for the inaugural. Reservations are being made so Louisvillians may view firsthand the brightest stars of the radio world." The following week, the Louisville Herald Post ran an article announcing the best of the network will join WAVE tomorrow night with native Louisvillian Floyd Bond as master of ceremonies. The Herald Post also announced that earlier on the 29th, at 2:30 in the morning, WAVE engineer Wilbur Hudson ran a test tone, and with the help of Westinghouse Laboratories in Tucope, Massachusetts, the Westinghouse engineers assured Hudson that the transmission was like $1 million. And on the same day, the Herald Post announced that WAVE engineers were to run a series of tones to do the final tuning of the transmitter, and that some of the tones were inaudible to human ears. It invited its listeners to set their dogs, cats, and canaries beside the radio sets and to write in their animals' reactions. The night is December 30th, 1933, and the Crystal Ballroom is at capacity. There was dancing, which stopped at 11 o'clock as the crowd listened over loudspeakers to the network. The program began at 11 p.m. as NBC in Chicago offered a salute to radio station WAVE. Featured on this program included Marcel Rodrigo, Wendell Hall, Irene Beasley, the Commodores Quartet, and Harry Coogan, entertaining from Chicago. At 11:15 p.m., NBC in New York began a salute with the Pickens Sisters and Countess Olga Albany as the featured artists. The final moment came as WAVE announcer Burt Blackwell uttered these words.
Louisville, gateway to the South, is on the air over the National Broadcasting Company. Station WAVE is presenting its first program. WAVE, a new station dedicating itself to the service of radio listeners, to the betterment and enjoyment of the people it serves. Programs of national importance, programs of local interest, music, sports, and all of the arts which are vocal will be yours at the twist of a dial on this wavelength granted by the Federal Communications Commission to the associated station of the National Broadcasting Company in Louisville. Station WAVE.
Then Louisville Mayor Neville Miller made a speech. As mayor of the city of Louisville, I extend to the management of WAVE and the National Broadcasting Company our heartiest good wishes for this news station and our thanks for the service extended to our homes. Congratulations and thank you. Then after the reading of telegrams from the likes of Stephen Early, Secretary to President Roosevelt, Postmaster James A. Farley, Senator Alvin Barkley, and Senator M.M. Logan, H. Ellsworth, President of NBC, and Credo Harris, manager of WHAS, the radio telephone of the Courier-Journal and Louisville Times. Entertainment was offered by Henry Halstead and his Californians, Sally Sweet, Edith Griffith, the Six Lucky Girls, Rosemary Deering, and many others. Finally, program director Reginald Billing led the audience in a stirring rendition of My Old Kentucky Home. Following this show, WAVE offered a salute to industry and then signed off the air. The Louisville Herald Post reported the next day that WAVE had been flooded with telegrams describing the reception of the news station, and the furthest came from Albuquerque, New Mexico. The Louisville Herald Post announced the schedule for the New Year's Eve would include the Capitol Theater broadcast at 10:30, Ian Garber's Orchestra at 2:30 p.m., the Catholic Hour at 5, Eddie Cantor at 7, the Bird Exposition at 10, and the Minneapolis Symphony Orchestra from 10:30 until 11:30. Then beginning at midnight, New Year's Day, the station will broadcast a program of dance music until 3 a.m. titled Dancing Across the Country. And through a series of station hookups, the arrival of 1934 would be broadcast from east to west coast. NBC continued this service for several decades to come. The other features of New Year's Day would include the Navy Band at 10 a.m., Roxy's Band at 10:15 a.m., the Tournament of Roses Parade at 11:45, the Radio Guild from 2 to 3 p.m., and the Rose Bowl, which pitted Columbia and Stanford from 3:30 to 6:30. Other programs included the Lawrence Tibbett Firestone Hour. On January 1, 1934, the Louisville Herald Post announced that auditions for talent were being accepted by WAVE between the hours of 10 in the morning and noon, and they were inviting all singers and musicians to come and perform. The announcing staffs of WAVE in 1934 included Burt Blackwell, Thomas Riley, and William Bond, who had worked for WLAP, and Merle Tucker, who came from Cincinnati's WLW. The program director was Reginald Billing. Later in 1934, George Patterson was elected program director. Mr. Patterson had been a former English teacher at DuPont Manual Training High School.
I went to WAVE in 1934, which is a long time ago, 57 years, I think it is. And I'm an old man now, so I'm afraid I'm going to forget some of the things that I would rather remember and tell the people about, tell you about, and anyone who may be listening. Anyway, I went in 1934, and at that time, George Norton was the owner of WAVE. Nate Lord was the manager. The announcers were Burt Blackwell and Bill Bond. Bill was the brother, the younger brother of Ford Bond, who was at an NBC announcer. And Wilbur Hudson was the chief engineer, and Johnny Ruffner was another engineer. At that time, we were, as most people may remember, on the top of the Brown Hotel, with, as we used to say, atop, the studios atop the Brown Hotel, which meant the 15th floor. So there was quite a ride in, on the elevator from the ground floor up to the lobby and then to the 15th floor. Sometimes we would go up the front elevator and sometimes the freight elevator. We didn't have any real programming from NBC to amount to anything at that time, so we had to do our own. Later, of course, we had many NBC programs, but at that time we didn't. So the programs that we put together in during that first period, I became program director after a short time when Reginald Billen went to England, and then I was appointed program director. We had hillbilly music in the middle of the day always. Clayton McMitchin, sometimes called Pappy McMitchin, and his and his outfit were on, as I remember, at 12 o'clock every day, from 12 to, I don't know, 12 to 1, I guess. And then there was Curly Fox and his outfit, and still another one whose name I've forgotten. In the afternoon, we would have studio programs of music, which we put together with Geraldine Fox playing the piano, accompanying the singers, and also sometimes Clifford Shaw, who was staff pianist. He was would make the accompany the singers. And Cliff wrote quite a number of pieces of music, which were published. He was quite a talented a composer, and we were all quite proud of him.
In early 1934, Variety magazine ran an article on WAVE's experiments with amateur shows on a local level. Program director George Patterson pioneered this idea, and WAVE was the only station in the country doing this type of programming. These programs originated at a Southern Indiana theater and offered prizes to the winners.